Imagine for a second that an adversary just suddenly destroys the satellite that's routing your GPS or your secure communications.
Right, which would be an absolute nightmare scenario.
Totally. And a decade ago, the military would essentially be completely blind for, what, like 6 months, while engineers just scrambled to put a replacement up in the sky.
Easily 6 months. It was a massive, incredibly slow logistical hurdle.
But on June 19, 2026, Rocket Lab actually proved that we can replace that critical orbital infrastructure from a completely cold start in under 17 hours.
Which is just staggering when you really think about it.
It really is. So today we are taking a deep dive into this amazing article titled Rocket Lab's Record-Breaking Victus Haze Mission. And our main goal is to figure out how the global space industry is shifting from the sluggish month-long planning process into a real-time tactical response capability.
Yeah, and what's fascinating here is that it really is a fundamental shift in how we view orbit. I mean, for the longest time, orbit was this bespoke, artisanal environment, right?
Like every launch was a precious scientific endeavor.
Exactly. Every single launch was treated like moving a priceless, delicate sculpture onto a pedestal made of explosives.
That is a great way to put it.
But this Victus Haze mission, it really demonstrates that we are officially moving away from that mindset. We are entering an era of high-tempo, factory-like operations.
So space is basically transitioning from a slow scientific environment into like a real-time tactical arena.
Precisely. It's an active tactical domain now.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Right.
Because to understand why this matters, we first need to look at exactly what just happened on the timeline. Because the sheer compression of time here breaks, like all the historical rules of aerospace.
It absolutely shatters them.
So on June 19th, 2026, at exactly 05:37 in the morning, the U.S. Space Force sends this notice to launch to Rocket Lab. And this isn't a scheduled thing, right? It's basically a cold call.
Right, a total cold call. They just say go.
So by 06:00 a.m., which is just 23 minutes later, the Rocket Lab team is activated. At noon, they literally start fueling the rocket. And by 10:19 p.m. local time, their Electron rocket lifts off from Launch Complex 1 in New Zealand.
Which is just
I mean,
incredible.
from a dead stop to the vacuum of space in 16 hours and 42 minutes. It's like we went from the Pony Express to ordering an entire satellite on Amazon Prime same-day delivery.
That is honestly exactly what it feels like. And to really appreciate how radical that compression of time is, you kind of have to look at the historical progression. So the U.S. military has this program called TACRS, which stands for Tactically Responsive Space, and it's run by the Space Safari Program Office.
Wait, Space Safari? That is an incredible name for a government office.
Right. It sounds fun, but their entire mandate is incredibly serious. They're tasked with figuring out how to do exactly this kind of rapid launch under immense pressure.
And the history of those tests kind of shows just how much we've struggled with speed in the past, doesn't it?
Oh, completely. Back in 2009, they ran the TaxSat-3 mission.
Yeah.
And rapid response back then. It took them 6 whole months to launch.
Wow. 6 months was considered fast.
Exactly. Then by 2011, with the ORS-1 mission, they managed to bring that down to 29 days.
Okay, that's a huge jump.
It was. But then you jump to September 2023. Firefly Aerospace ran the Victus Nox mission and set what was, at the time, a massive record of 27 hours.
And now Rocket Lab just shaved another 10 hours off that.
Right. And, the Space Safari Program Office, they aren't just pulling out a stopwatch when the rocket leaves the pad.
They're measuring the whole process.
Exactly. They measure success across multiple dimensions of stress. So they track the time from that initial notice to the actual launch, sure. But then they also measure the time from launch to orbital insertion.
And then I'm guessing the time it actually takes for the satellite to turn on.
Yes. The time from orbital insertion to the satellite achieving full operational capability. It is a massive stress test of the entire logistics chain.
Well, that logistics chain is exactly what I want to dig into next, because you can't just, mandate a 16-hour launch window and expect some traditional 1990s-era rocket to just comply.
No, definitely not.
Their record was only possible because they basically reimagined the fundamental engineering, right?
Right.
With their Electron rocket.
They really did. You simply cannot achieve a 16-hour turnaround with legacy architecture. I mean, the Electron is an 18-meter-tall vehicle, and its structure is made entirely of carbon composite.
Which is super lightweight.
Right. That material choice is vital because it makes the rocket incredibly light but extremely rigid. And that drastically improves what we call the payload fraction.
Payload fraction meaning basically the percentage of the rocket's total mass that is actually useful cargo.
Exactly.
Rather than just the heavy metal tubes and all the fuel needed to lift it.
Precisely. Because, you know, every ounce of the rocket itself just becomes dead weight once the fuel burns off. Carbon composites keep that structural weight incredibly low.
Right. But the materials are only half the story. The real departure from traditional engineering is in the propulsion, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The Electron uses these Rutherford engines. There are 9 of them on the first stage and 1 on the second stage. And they use additive manufacturing to build them.
Additive manufacturing. So basically 3D printing.
Yes. 3D printing.
But how does printing an engine actually speed up the timeline from a cold call order to a launch? I mean, a printed engine doesn't fly faster.
Yeah, it doesn't fly faster, but it completely changes the entire supply chain beforehand. You see, traditional rocket engines are built using casting, forging, and all this complex machining.
Sounds like it takes forever.
It does. You have to wait for forged parts to cool down. You have to source specific alloys from a dozen different vendors, and you have to weld these intricate cooling channels by hand. It takes months.
Oh, wow.
But with additive manufacturing, you essentially put metal powder in, lasers melt it layer by layer, and a nearly complete engine comes out in just days.
Just days. That is wild.
Right. So if the Space Force asks for a rocket immediately, Rocket Lab doesn't have to wait 3 months for some subcontractor to ship a specialized valve. They can literally just print the parts they need.
Okay. So they have 3D printed engines, which solves the supply chain issue. But the way they actually feed fuel into those engines is even more unusual, right? Because traditional rockets use turbopumps to push the fuel into the combustion chamber.
Yeah, and turbopumps are notoriously difficult to work with. They're an engineering nightmare.
Why are they so bad?
Well, a turbopump is essentially a massive, incredibly powerful jet engine bolted onto the side of the actual rocket engine. And its only job is to spin fast enough to force thousands of gallons of propellant into the main combustion chamber.
That sounds violently complicated.
It is. To run a turbopump, you usually need a gas generator, which is basically a smaller, separate combustion chamber just to create the high-pressure gas that spins the turbine. It requires this crazy labyrinth of plumbing, seals, and valves.
Which means there are thousands of tiny moving parts that could just vibrate apart or freeze or explode during a launch.
Exactly. They require massive amounts of testing, calibration, and really delicate handling. But Rocket Lab completely threw that architecture out the window.
They just got rid of the turbopumps.
Yep. Instead of turbopumps and gas generators, the Electron rocket uses an electric propellant feed system.
And this is where I get slightly lost. Because they power those electric pumps with onboard lithium polymer batteries, right?
That's right.
Oh, wait. If we just talked about how important payload fraction is, how every single ounce really matters, why on earth would you add the dead weight of massive lithium batteries to a spacecraft?
I know, it seems completely counterintuitive to add heavy batteries.
Yeah.
But if we connect this to the bigger picture, it's a very deliberate engineering trade-off.
Okay, how so?
Think of it like replacing a really complex mechanical Swiss watch with a solid-state digital microchip. You are intentionally sacrificing a tiny bit of performance carrying those heavy batteries to completely eliminate the gas generators, the intricate plumbing, and the turbines.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, you strip out one of the most fragile, complicated systems in all of aerospace. The electric system is basically just wires running from a battery to an electric motor.
So it makes the rocket infinitely more reliable.
Exactly. And because it's so much simpler, you don't need weeks of delicate calibration before you launch. You can confidently turn it around in 16 hours.
That makes total sense. You're basically buying reliability and speed with a little bit of weight.
Precisely.
But it's not just the hardware that they optimize, right? It's also the location. The article highlights that this launch required a ground team of fewer than 20 people. And they launched from Launch Complex 1, which is on the Mahia Peninsula in New Zealand.
Yes. Geography is a massive and often overlooked enabler for speed. Launch Complex 1 is uniquely situated in the Southern Hemisphere and is far away from major population centers.
Unlike launching from, say, Florida.
Right. In the U.S., if you launch from Florida or California, you are dealing with massive amounts of commercial air traffic. You have to negotiate airspace closures with the FAA days or even weeks in advance.
But in New Zealand?
In New Zealand, Rocket Lab has already pre-coordinated all those aviation and airspace regulations. It's essentially their own private spaceport.
And the physical orientation of the peninsula matters too, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The Mahia Peninsula offers highly flexible weather windows, and it points in a direction that gives them direct access to polar and sun-synchronous orbits.
Okay, let's define that really quickly. A sun-synchronous orbit means the satellite is passing over a specific spot on Earth at the exact same local solar time every single day.
Exactly. So, for example, if it passes over Paris at noon on Tuesday, it's going to pass over Paris at noon on Wednesday.
Which is crucial for military reconnaissance, right?
Yeah, it is. Because it means the shadows in the photographs are consistent day after day. If a shadow suddenly gets longer, you know, an adversary built a taller building or moved a missile silo, rather than just the sun being at a different angle.
Right. That is so clever. So we have this highly optimized carbon composite 3D printed rocket launching from a private peninsula in 16 hours.
The ultimate delivery truck.
Exactly. But building a fast delivery truck is totally pointless if the cargo you are delivering takes weeks to unpack.
Right. The payload is half the battle.
So let's look at that payload. For Victus Hayes, the payload was a 250-kilogram satellite named Pioneer, which was built by a company called True Anomaly. And Pioneer had to meet its own grueling timeline.
This is exactly where the industry historically hit a huge bottleneck. Because traditionally, once a satellite is dropped off in orbit, you can't just flip a switch and start using it right away.
Because the deployment is so violent.
Exactly. The vibrations and G-forces are extreme. So engineers usually spend weeks, sometimes months, waking up systems one by one. They carefully deploy the solar panels, wait for thermal systems to stabilize in the intense heat and cold of space, and run all these diagnostics.
Just to make sure nothing short-circuited.
Right. It takes forever.
But the Space Force gave True Anomaly a strict 72-hour deadline to go from orbital insertion to fully operational, and Pioneer managed to do it in just 38 hours.
Which is phenomenal.
So how do you skip the weeks of careful calibration without just, you know, blowing out the satellite's electronics?
Well, you simulate the environment heavily before you ever put it on the rocket.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, instead of physically testing the satellite against the vacuum and temperature shifts for the first time while it's actually up in space, True Anomaly used highly automated digital ground simulation.
So they mapped it all out digitally.
Exactly. They mapped all the thermal and vibrational variables beforehand. So when Pioneer woke up in orbit, its software essentially already knew its environment.
So the satellite trusted its own internal models enough to just boot up rapidly?
Yes. It didn't require engineers on the ground to handhold every single subsystem.
Okay, so it boots up fast, but once it's turned on, what exactly is it doing? I mean, getting a rocket up fast is cool, but if you just launch a basic radio relay, that doesn't really solve a complex tactical problem for the military.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
But Pioneer is definitely not a basic radio relay. The specs on it are intense. It has chemical thrusters, radar, advanced imaging, and RF sensors.
RF sensors, so radio frequency sensors.
Yes. They act like highly sensitive ears in orbit. They allow Pioneer to actively listen to communications or radar signals emitting from other objects in space.
So it's not just a passive camera, it's an active intelligence gatherer.
Exactly. And the official military terminology used in the source material states that Pioneer can perform what they call dynamic engagements.
Dynamic engagements. That sounds like a very sterile way of saying something intense.
It is. It's a sterile way of saying that Pioneer is designed to maneuver. It can rendezvous with, pursue, and physically interact with moving targets in space.
Wait, really? It can pursue things?
Yes. It can perform close proximity inspections of unknown objects and execute rapid collision avoidance maneuvers.
So instead of launching, like, a stationary security camera, we essentially just launched a high-speed pursuit vehicle into orbit, like a tow truck crossed with a patrol car.
That is a perfect analogy. Mm-hmm. It is a high-agility tactical platform. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the U.S. government is funding the development of these orbital patrol cars isn't happening in a vacuum.
Right. It's a response to a much bigger problem.
Exactly. It's a direct response to the massive vulnerabilities of modern 21st century warfare.
Which brings us to the underlying reality of why this extreme speed is so necessary. Because if a satellite goes down, it's not just a military issue, right?
Oh, no. It affects everyone.
Like you driving to work right now, you would immediately lose the GPS routing on your phone. Supply chains would just grind to a halt.
The financial sector would collapse. They rely on GPS timing signals to timestamp high-frequency stock trades.
Right. So if the satellites go down, modern civilian life just degrades in a matter of hours.
And for the military, the consequences are even steeper. Satellites run their secure communications, their intelligence gathering, and the coordination of precision strikes.
So if an adversary takes them out, they're crippled.
Completely. If an adversary can disable those critical satellites using anti-satellite missiles or cyber attacks or signal jamming, a modern military force is essentially deaf and blind.
Let's walk through the hypothetical scenario that the military strategists present in our sources.
Okay.
Imagine an adversary suddenly destroys three critical U.S. reconnaissance satellites in low Earth orbit. Before TAC-RS, the U.S. is essentially blind for 3 to 6 months while engineers scramble to build and launch placement.
Right. So the adversary knows they have a complete, uncontested strategic advantage for half a year.
But now, apply the Victus Hayes timeline to that exact scenario. With the capability to launch an Electron rocket in 16 hours, the U.S. could launch three rockets globally and replace those destroyed assets in, like, 24 hours?
Exactly. The adversary's six-month advantage completely evaporates. It just becomes a one-day inconvenience.
But this raises an important question for me. If we are actively building systems specifically to instantly replace assets destroyed in orbital combat, aren't we just officially accepting that space is now an active war zone?
It's a really sobering reality to consider. However, the military strategists framing this in our source material view, this rapid launch capability strictly through the lens of deterrence.
Deterrence. How does speed deter an attack?
It all comes down to mathematical calculation. If an adversary knows they have to spend millions of dollars and risk major international condemnation to launch an anti-satellite weapon, they might still do it if they gain a six-month tactical advantage.
Because the payoff is worth the risk.
Right. But if they know you can replace that destroyed satellite the very next afternoon for a fraction of the cost, the attack yields almost zero tactical benefit.
Oh, I see. So by making your space assets instantly replaceable, you totally change the math.
Exactly. You make the domain mathematically defensible, which theoretically deters the attack from ever happening in the first place.
So speed actually equals peace in a strange geopolitical way.
That's the theory, yes.
But the U.S. isn't the only nation doing this math, are they? There is a massive global space race happening right now, centered specifically around this concept of responsive space.
Absolutely. The China National Space Administration, along with private Chinese commercial companies like Galactic Energy and iSpace, are heavily prioritizing quick launch capabilities.
And what about Russia?
Russia, despite their economic constraints right now, is continuing to invest in modernizing their Soyuz rockets to maintain rapid access to orbit.
And Europe?
The European Union is definitely recognizing the vulnerability, though their strategy currently leans toward leveraging commercial partnerships rather than trying to build entirely indigenous government systems from scratch.
And that reliance on commercial partnerships is so key, because while the military acts as the primary catalyst and funder for this extreme speed, the ripple effects are fundamentally transforming the civilian and commercial space industries.
They really are. The technologies forged under the pressure of these TAC-RS tests bleed directly into commercial applications that you and I rely on.
Though there are still significant hurdles to making this an everyday commercial reality, right?
Oh, definitely. Cost is still a primary limitation. An Electron launch costs about $7.5 million, and it carries roughly 300 kilograms to orbit.
Okay, so compare that to a SpaceX Falcon 9.
Right. A Falcon 9 costs around $67 million per launch, but it carries a massive 22,800 kilograms. So on a strictly cost per kilogram basis, the Electron is significantly more expensive.
Not to mention manufacturing limits. Right now, Rocket Lab only has the capacity to produce, what, about 12 to 15 rockets a year?
Yeah, their production volume is still scaling up. And of course, no matter how fast you fuel the rocket or how perfectly you simulated the satellite on the ground, weather is an undefeated variable.
Right. High winds or lightning will just scrub a launch regardless of how fast you want to go.
Exactly. Those logistical and environmental constraints are very real. Maintaining a supply chain that can support unpredictable on-demand launches requires an entirely new way of managing inventory.
But even with those hurdles, the civilian applications for a 16-hour launch window are just transformative.
They really are. Think about a company like Starlink.
Oh, yeah. If a solar flare knocks out a cluster of their internet satellites over a specific region, they wouldn't have to wait months to hitch a ride on a scheduled heavy lift rocket.
Exactly. They could launch a dedicated replacement payload immediately and fix the sudden outage for their customers in a day.
I was also thinking about Earth imaging. The sources mention companies like Planet Labs.
Yes, that's a perfect example.
Imagine a huge hurricane hits a vulnerable coastal region or massive earthquake strikes. Emergency responders desperately need high-resolution maps of the destroyed roads and bridges to route aid, right?
Right. And normally they have to wait days for an existing satellite's orbit to eventually pass over that specific disaster zone.
But with this tech, a commercial provider could launch a dedicated imaging satellite specifically tailored to that region within 24 hours of the earthquake.
Exactly. Could save countless lives. Or consider the financial sector we discussed earlier. Financial firms could deploy dedicated low-latency communication relays on demand to secure high-frequency trading routes.
The telecom industry could instantly repair service blackouts. The possibilities are wild.
They are.
You know, here's where it gets really interesting to me. When you look at the commercial market, it seems like Rocket Lab and SpaceX aren't even really competing for the same job.
No, they serve completely different niches.
It's like, okay, think of it this way. Electron is basically a wildly expensive high-speed motorcycle courier rushing an urgent organ transplant across a congested city.
Right.
Whereas a SpaceX Falcon 9 is a massive cargo train. The train is way cheaper per pound, but it only leaves the station when all the boxcars are full, and it only stops at predetermined stations. The motorcycle courier leaves right now and goes exactly where you tell it to.
That analogy perfectly captures the current market dynamics. And it actually validates something profound about the aerospace industry today.
What's that?
Rocket Lab is proving that lean, private sector innovation can genuinely outmaneuver the massive traditional defense contractors.
Like Boeing or Lockheed Martin.
Exactly. The legacy companies that used to dictate the pace of space exploration are now trying to catch up to the standards set by smaller, agile, private firms.
And Rocket Lab isn't stopping at the motorcycle courier size either. They are currently developing a much larger rocket called Neutron.
Yes, which is highly anticipated.
It's expected to arrive somewhere between 2025 and 2027. And Neutron will have a 13,000 kilogram payload capacity, plus a reusable first stage.
So they are actively trying to bring the costs down and increase the cargo size while still maintaining that rapid response 3D printed DNA.
The U.S. Space Force is also looking ahead, investigating concepts like satellite on a shelf.
Which is exactly what it sounds like. Pre-built satellites sitting fully assembled in warehouses, just waiting for a rocket.
They're also looking at air launch systems, where rockets are dropped from airplanes to just completely avoid weather delays at ground pads.
They're even exploring in-space manufacturing.
Wait, building them in space?
Yeah, which would eliminate the launch delay entirely by just building the replacement parts directly in orbit. The infrastructure is just evolving so rapidly.
It's unbelievable. So when we step back and look at this whole Victus Haze mission, what does this all mean for you, the listener?
It means the space frontier is no longer this distant, slow-moving realm reserved for decades-long science experiments.
Right. Space has been democratized. And in this new era, speed and tactical agility are the ultimate currency. The ability to go from a cold order to a functioning satellite in under 40 hours fundamentally secures the hidden infrastructure of our modern lives.
It really does. It ensures the GPS in your car, the transactions in your bank account, and global disaster relief efforts remain intact, even in an increasingly volatile geopolitical climate.
And, you know, that democratization leaves us with a fascinating final thought to consider. We just talked about Pioneer, that high-agility satellite capable of pursuing and inspecting other objects in space.
A patrol car.
Well, if rapid launch technology and these maneuverable pursuit vessels become cheap and widely accessible, not just to global superpowers, but to smaller private actors or even individual corporations, How on earth will international law handle space traffic? Oh. Think about it. If a private company can quietly launch a highly maneuverable satellite in just 16 hours specifically to pull up next to and closely inspect a competitor's proprietary satellite, we might need to figure out the legal definitions of space trespassing much sooner than we ever anticipated.
That is a wild, very real implication. The corporate espionage angle in orbit.
Right. We went from waiting 6 months for an artisanal piece of hardware to reach orbit to a world where corporations might be launching high-speed orbital pursuit vehicles on a Tuesday afternoon. We really are watching the rules of gravity and geopolitics being rewritten in real time.
We truly are.
Well, thanks for joining us on this deep dive, and we'll catch you next time.